Okay, members, we'll bring the Committee of Health and Human Services Reform to order. We do have a quorum present, and so we'll do the first order of the day is passing the minutes for March 22nd, 2016. Do I have a motion to move the minutes? Representative Dean moves the minutes for March 22nd. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Okay, members, the first bill up on the calendar is Representative Peterson's House File 2613. Representative Peterson, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd move that House File 2613 be moved, and I also do have a DE1 amendment.
Okay, members, Representative Peterson will move her DE1 amendment to get the bill in the order that she would like. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Representative Peterson, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 2613 is the first step to building a system for care for heart attack patients across Minnesota. A STEMI is the most deadly type of heart attack, and it's almost complete blockage of the coronary artery. When someone has a STEMI, time is critical. They need immediate medical attention, and a STEMI system is coordinated and standardized approach to speed up all parts of the medical care. And so this bill is similar to the Minnesota Stroke System. It's a voluntary program and has attracted over 80 hospitals. No hospital is required to participate or change their approach to cardiac care at all. Hospitals that choose to get accredited nationally can choose to apply for MDH or state level designation. And House File 2613 also requires EMS services to have current protocols for treating STEMI patients. This is fully supported by the Minnesota Ambulance Association, who will also be testifying. And the American Heart Association has spent the last 3 years investing over $6 million into the infrastructure need for a Minnesota STEMI system. Then I'd like to ask my testifier, Richard Mullivane, who is the cardiovascular clinical pharmacist with Ichsenshaw Health Heart and Vascular Center, to tell you a little bit more.
Yes, Richard Mullivane, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee. If you could just introduce yourself.
My name is Richard Mullivane, and I'm a clinical pharmacist, but I'm also the heart attack STEMI program manager for Ichsenshaw Health up in Duluth, Minnesota. And I've also been the co-chair of the Minnesota Mission Lifeline project that you had mentioned. It's been a three-year project, grant-based, and it's coming to its conclusion. But out of the project itself, the goal was to improve heart attack care in Minnesota, primarily improve rural heart attack care because they're farther away from the hospitals, and by coordinating efforts between ambulance services and hospitals, writing protocols for both EMS, the emergency medical folks, as well as the hospitals, we've been able to hopefully streamline and standardize care, and the goal, of course, is to improve outcomes. And I believe we've already seen some of the fruits of the labor where we've seen an improvement in mortality across different counties in Minnesota.
Okay, thank you so much. Appreciate you being here today. Representative Peterson, do you have other testifiers as well?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay. Is there anyone else from the audience who wants to testify for the bill or with concerns about the bill? Okay, not seeing anyone. Members, questions? Okay, Representative Peterson. It's a very popular bill today, it sounds like. Important and laudable direction that we're going in trying to address this critical need. So thank you for bringing it forward. Members, with that, Representative Peterson will renew her motion that House File 2613, as amended, be recommended to be referred to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Peterson. Members, the next bill we'll take up is House File 3191, Representative Miller. Welcome to the committee, Representative Miller. I will move that House File 2803 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. We have the bill in front of us, and I understand you have a DE1 amendment, Representative Miller.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Okay, I will move the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the order that the author would like. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Representative Miller, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I hope this is the second most popular bill on the day. So, As I'm sure all of you know, we passed the Safe Harbor Law in 2011 and funded it, I believe, 2 years later. And last year I was proud to carry the bill that allowed us to fund it even further. And so this year we're coming before your committee. In part, when it moves forward, we'll also ask for some additional funding into this so that we can approach and reach the ultimate goal of what the whole program was put together and intended and what was expected to be funded for. So we'll be doing that. But however, we also have a policy portion of this in that it expands the services, the people eligible for these services, youth and youth at risk for ages up to 24. And I will let one of my testifiers, Jeff Bauer of the Family Partnership, give the reasons as to why we're doing that.
Wonderful. Welcome to the committee. Thank you for being here. If you could just introduce yourself and proceed.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Jeff Bauer. I'm the Vice President of Public Affairs at the Family Partnership. I want to thank you all for your time today. Thank Representative Miller for once again carrying this bill. CeCe for making what I think might have been a fairly harrowing drive here from Heartland Girls Ranch today. And also, always, Ms. Iverson for answering about a bajillion questions I had before today, so thanks for that. As Representative Miller stated, since the Safe Harbor Bill passed in 2011 and since we first came to this committee in 2013 seeking support for funding, we've done a lot, and we've done that with your support. It's always good to look around the table in a hearing, and I think probably every single one of you has been a co-author on one of these bills, so thank you all for that. In the past several years, we've done a number of things. We now have 6 shelter and housing sites around the state of Minnesota. That's 45 emergency shelter and longer-term shelter beds for youth who have been trafficked. When we started this conversation a couple years ago, I think we had 2. So that's a lot of progress in a short amount of time. We now have 13 grant-funded projects around the state providing services to sex trafficked youth. We've trained over 2,000 law enforcement professionals around the state to identify victims of sex trafficking and to investigate cases. And we now have 10 regional navigators around the state to connect youth who have been exploited to the support and services they need. And so that's a lot of work in a short amount of time. And I always feel slightly ungrateful coming in front of this committee with all of that work having happened in such a short amount of time. But I do need to tell you, and you know this, that we're not there yet. We're not where we need to be for sexually exploited youth in our state. We currently are funded at $8 million in the base moving forward for Safe Harbor. Our ask has not changed since 2013. It's $13.3 million to fully fund Minnesota's Safe Harbor model. And so we're back this year asking for 5.3 additional, and I just want to run down that super quickly since I know we're in reform committee, and then talk about the age provision. So what we're really looking at moving forward is we need more shelter beds in more places across the state of Minnesota. We're really running into a geographical problem right now. As we've trained more law enforcement officers and people around the state to identify victims, they're identifying victims. It actually happens almost immediately. We do a training, and within a week, they're finding these kids, and they don't have anywhere to bring them in too many places in the state of Minnesota. So more shelter beds in more places, more services in more places, and we also need to do more outreach in more places to reach these kids where they are. So I know we'll talk about the money a little bit more in Chair Dean's committee, but the policy provision in this bill I want to talk about really briefly today is extending Safe Harbor shelter and services through the age of 24. This mirrors a change that was made to the Homeless Youth Act last year that has really done well to get youth, more youth connected to the shelter and housing they need. We see the same thing with Safe Harbor. It shouldn't be that a child who's been trafficked since she was 13 on her 18th birthday can no longer stay in Safe Harbor shelter and can no longer receive Safe Harbor services. And so we're just asking for a change to mirror the same change that happened with Homeless Youth Act last year. I want to be really clear about the fact that this does not change Minnesota's Safe Harbor law. And so Minnesota's Safe Harbor law would still apply to youth under the age of 18. All it does is it authorizes that the funding used for shelter and services can be extended out to serve youth through the age of 24. And so with that, I can either take questions, Madam Chair, or turn it over to CeCe Turlow, whatever you would like.
Okay, why don't we'll finish with testimony, and then we'll go to member questions. So welcome to the committee. If you could just introduce yourself and proceed.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Cece Terlau, and I'm the Executive Director of Strategic Development at the Heartland Girls Ranch in Benson, Minnesota. And I first would like to extend a thank you to Representative Miller, who actually represents our district, and to Jeff Bauer for all the work they've done to really promote and to provide help to get these services on board for trafficked youth. Heartland Girls Ranch is a residential group home, and we serve at-risk and sexually exploited girls, and we use equine horse programming to promote the healing. And since the Safe Harbor Law has gone into effect, we have been able to provide specialized services for since the onset in the fall of 2014. We worked with 24 girls, and at this point we're looking to actually extend our services, get more beds. We're at 8 beds temporarily right now and looking to extend to 12. I wanted to talk a little bit about this bill and the fact that I think many people know that much of the brain studies and the information about our brains has really developed in the last few years. And once a child reaches 18, it's not time to abandon these victims. All of the most recent scientific studies of the brain have proven that young people's brains, specifically the prefrontal cortex, does not fully develop until they reach the age of 25. So the areas that this controls is the cognitive development and decision making, logical thinking, impulse control, risk management, and complex planning, which there's much more, but that alone is saying a lot. The experts are saying that additional support is needed for young people, the average young people, through this time. And then you think about a child that has been trafficked since they were 13 or 14, and just the delays and the struggles they've had. They are definitely needed. It's critical for them to continue having the type of support, that specialized support, that they can get by extending the services through 24. At Heartland Ranch, we have seen a lot of 16 and 17-year-olds come through our programming, and it's really difficult to get them moving forward. I mean, we're working with them, but then if they have to leave our services before they're really ready to be able to launch on their own and have the skills needed to be successful, that makes it very difficult. I'm hearing stories of young ladies that are not getting services or on the streets or having to go back to their traffickers because there just isn't any options for them. And so I am here to just ask that you really consider moving that age limit through to 24. I think it's vitally important, and I appreciate the opportunity to share that. Thank you.
Thank you for taking the time to drive down and be here. We really appreciate it. A question from Representative Mallory.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Bauer, actually, I really get into the brain development, and it's even further now. It's up to 30, so it's not 25. Probably we're going to find out it's even longer. And I don't disagree with your bill. My concern is, yes, it's true that it's still not developed at 18, but it's much more developed by 2022. My big concern is, having known the person who ran one of your shelters and how short they were for space for the number that are needed, are we going to, if we had enough money to expand to take that up, I'd have no problem. My problem is, the most at risk are the younger ones. And are we going to not be able to take some of the really most at risk because we're taking more that are still at risk but not quite as high at risk?
Mr. Bauer.
Unless you've got some money coming down from heaven or something, Anna.
Mr. Bauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Mallory. There is no money coming down that I've seen. The other interesting thing about the brain science is it takes men's brains several years longer to fully develop than women's.
I heard that. We knew that, Dave.
Yeah, which will seem self-explanatory to the women in the room, but I just learned that. But
Nice.
You guys can all thank me later for that. So to answer your question, I mean, of course, we are, you know, fundamentally and primarily concerned with the youngest victims and the most vulnerable. The year one study that came out from the Department of Health about the first year of implementation with the Safe Harbor model showed a lot of things. One, the geographic disparities that I talked about earlier, but what it also really showed, almost every provider that we talked to around the state, in addition to supporting the really young ones, named this need, this 18 through 24 year old group, as one of the most pressing needs, because that's who they're seeing more than anybody else in these programs. And so based on the capacity that they have, based on their programming moving forward, I haven't heard from any of them that expanding the age to 24 would mean a space crunch or would mean pushing out the younger ones. If I did think that, you know, I certainly think we would hesitate to put this bill forward. If it's helpful to you, I'm happy to have some of the providers, you know, provide more of that information to you. But we've seen that this would not only work given the space we have, but that it's a priority for a lot of providers. And I'm not sure if CC has anything to add.
Madam Chair,
Representative Mulry,
I totally agree with the need for the bill. I was just worried that we're not. It's great to treat ones that need it, but the most at risk I want to get at. So if we're not endangering that risk getting the treatment, then I have no problem.
Thank you.
Members, other questions? Not seeing any. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to go back to something that was said earlier about this not changing the Safe Harbor law. And by that, I assume that you meant the decriminalization of the conduct. So, you know, obviously it would complicate the bill, and it would have to go to different places were that to be in there. But I just wondered if you wanted to comment about the fact that, you know, we're expanding under the bill, we're expanding the services to age 24, which I think is totally appropriate. But I also wonder if it creates kind of an odd situation where someone can still be criminally prosecuted for prostitution at the same time that, you know, on one part of our law and on another part we're recognizing them as a victim instead of a perpetrator. And, you know, did you want to say something more about that?
Mr. Bauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Liebling. It is a bit of a tricky policy position to be in, and what I'll say is that in having these discussions for, you know, the past year to get ready for this legislative session, what we found was a lot of support for expanding access to the shelter and services. What we found is a little bit more of a comprehensive discussion that's taking place around the age of the actual age of decriminalization. I would have loved to have had more of a consensus amongst whether it's the statewide human trafficking task force or folks more broadly. I didn't feel that we had enough of a consensus at this time to push for that change, either amongst legislators or amongst the coalition. What I will say is, in theory, the principle of the fact that no one should be criminalized for their own exploitation, right? Like, I think that's something we all agree on. I think what we're trying to work out is how to implement that in the best possible way that serves victims well. You know, we've been really careful rolling out Safe Harbor to not get ahead of ourselves. And, you know, to get back to Representative Mullery's question, to make sure before we change things to have the shelter beds in place and the services in place. And so I think the next year or two with expanding eligibility is going to teach us a lot about the road forward. So it's not a perfect answer, but that's where we are right now.
Thank you.
Okay, members, not seeing any further questions. Representative Nash, final word on your bill?
How about?
Excuse me.
No, that's okay.
Representative Miller, I am sorry. Representative Miller, final word on your bill.
No offense, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I want to thank everyone for hearing this. This law and this policy, Safe Harbor, is very important to me. So much so that my wife and I have volunteered out at Heartland Girls Ranch. My wife continues to volunteer on a regular basis, and I guess my plug is to everyone in this room, this is a problem in this state, and I ask everyone to consider helping in any way that they can. So I ask for this committee's support on this bill.
Thank you, Representative Miller, and thank you for the work you put into it last year and this year. Your commitment to it is very much appreciated, and lots of work yet to be done, so I appreciate this next step. Members, with that, all of those, I will renew my motion that House File 3191, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Miller, and thank you to the testifiers.
Thank you.
Members, the next bill we're going to take up is House File 2469, Representative Knobloch. And members, I will move that House File 2469 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. And Representative Knobloch, I understand we have an amendment, the A16-0914 amendment.
Yes, I'd appreciate if that you put that on.
Okay, members, I will move the A16-0914 amendment to get the bill in the order that the author would like. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Representative Knobloch, two-year bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House File 2469, as amended, allows a funeral home with one or more prep rooms. Prep rooms are where embalming or other funeral preparation work is done. Allows a funeral home with one or more prep rooms to hold viewings and funerals in branch funeral homes that do not have prep rooms. Under legislation enacted some years ago, all funeral home locations as of June 30th, 2017 are required to have a prep room that meets state licensing requirements. A licensed prep room can cost well over $100,000. However, there are many funeral homes, particularly in greater Minnesota, that do not currently have a prep room at each funeral home location. Instead, they have one or two locations with licensed prep rooms and use their other locations for viewings and funerals as an alternative to churches, Legion clubs, VFWs, or places where other viewings and funerals are often held. If House File 2469 does not move forward, funeral homes will be required to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on unneeded prep rooms, which will be passed on to their customers in the form of higher prices or shut down their branch locations. And many of these branch locations are in small towns in rural Minnesota, which will then lose their funeral home if this bill does not move forward. Members, I would urge your support for this bill. I have with me two witnesses, Tim Crook, who spent many years with the Department of Health in their Mortuary Science Division, and Paul Daniel, who owns the Daniel Family Funeral Home business in St. Cloud, Minnesota.
Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce whichever one of you would like to go first, introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, representatives. My name is Timothy Cook. It's spelled K-O-C-H, and I was the mortician investigator with the Department of Health Mortuary Science Section for 18 years, and for approximately 20 months after that, I was the interim manager of that section. I left the Department of Health in February of 2013, and I am now in private practice in the funeral industry. I came here today because I wanted to keep an eye on the House file that the Representative Knobloch was introducing, because last year I sat on my hands in private practice and watched a couple bills go through and become law that I think adversely affected the industry. Today when I arrived, I saw that the House File 2469 was amended, and I was fortunate enough to be able to spend a couple minutes with Representative Knobloch and tell him that I was totally in support not only of his bill but now also of his amendment. I have two comments about the amendment A16-0914. My first comment is, in my opinion, relying on my 20 years of experience in the mortuary science section at the Minnesota Department of Health, there is no health risk posed by this amendment. And secondly, I want to say that without this amendment, there will be funeral homes in greater Minnesota that will be forced to close their doors because of last year's changing of the regulation, which requires that funeral homes update their preparation rooms, even though they are not being used, to today's standards. With that bill, which forces the funeral homes to update their funeral homes by July of 2017, funeral homes across greater Minnesota, in my opinion, will close because the funeral home owners will not want to spend the large amounts of money in small towns where they simply do 6 to 12 or 15 or so funerals a year. It's not economically feasible for them to do that. And so what that does is it puts a burden on the consumers to go to bigger towns where there are preparation rooms at larger funeral homes, but it leaves their small towns with one more empty business, one more closed doors, and they also have to drive out of town to go to visitations and funerals. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you for taking the time to be here.
And if I could introduce Mr. Daniel with Daniel Funeral Homes.
Thank you for being here. If you could just introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Paul Daniel, and I'm presently the President and Chief Executive Officer of the Daniel Funeral Home in St. Cloud. We currently also have chapels in Sartell, Clearwater, St. Joseph, and Painesville. My family has been in funeral service in St. Cloud and central Minnesota for 135 years. And our family business started in 1881. I am a fourth-generation funeral director in our family business. Just to show you how fast things can change, I wrote this little presentation yesterday about noon, and Representative Knobloch already has a different amendment, which is before you. So this happens kind of fast. But I'm here today to talk to you about this amendment and about the reinstatement of what is commonly known as the grandfather clause back in Minnesota Statute 149A. This clause was removed during the 2015 legislative session. It states that if a preparation and embalming room that has not been used for the preparation or embalming of a dead human body in the previous 12 months prior to July 1st of 1997, it is exempt from the minimum requirements of prep room compliance. This clause also states that the time of ownership changes, a funeral home gets sold, the building location changes, the building moves, or the funeral home is remodeled, the existing preparation room must be brought into compliance with minimum standards of 149A. This clause was removed during the last legislative session, and I'm asking this clause and this amendment to be reinstated. The removal of this clause has caused an enormous burden on some, but not all funeral homes in the state of Minnesota. These funeral homes are mainly in outstate Minnesota, and many are older family-owned funeral homes in small towns where no body preparation is done. Our contention that over the course of time, all of these buildings will have to be compliant with prep rooms, even if they will never be used for body preparation. Remember, I wrote this before Jim's amendment. The trend of funeral homes in Minnesota is a centrally located preparation room where all or most embalming is done. In no way are we asking for the laws to be relaxed where the embalming is done. What is happening is that we are being asked to update prep rooms and buildings where there will never be any prep work done. This seems to place a heavy burden on some funeral homes in the state. It is our contention that this would not be a benefit to the general public, as there's not going to be any body preparation done here anyway. If the Minnesota Department of Health has a concern about the upgrading of prep rooms in these older buildings for body preparation, have them issue an order to decommission these older prep rooms. The Minnesota Department of Health, under the law in its current form, will no longer permit any body, even an embalmed, prepared, and casketed body, in any funeral home where there is no compliant prep rooms. This can inhibit funeral homes from effectively serving the public in these smaller towns. One of the ironies of the current law is that the Minnesota Department of Health is requiring a prep room that may never be used in a funeral establishment when they do not require a prep room in any church, school gymnasium, community center, city hall, or any other public or private building where a visitation may occur. Why are embalmed, casketed bodies allowed in churches, school gymnasiums, community centers, and not allowed in certain funeral homes? Remember, the Minnesota Department of Health is responsible to regulate the disposition of all human remains in Minnesota, not just in funeral establishments. One of the possible unintended consequences of the removal of this grandfather clause is the huge financial burden cost to some funeral homes. Many of these older buildings simply do not have prep rooms in the first place. But these buildings are currently licensed as funeral establishments by the Minnesota Department of Health. This law would require certain funeral homes to install, remodel, rebuild, or close funeral homes if this grandfather clause or amendment is not reinstated. A better solution to alleviate the concerns of the Minnesota Department of Health would be to consider some options. For example, a prep room for a certain number of locations, a radius of miles of a fully compliant prep room, or one fully compliant prep room for so many death calls. There are other alternatives the legislature could look at. Lastly, in my opinion, there has been a general consensus by our funeral association that there has been a great amount of support from the licensed funeral directors to upgrade all prep rooms in all funeral home establishments. I can tell you that in my 34 years of being a funeral director, that I have never seen a more divisive issue among funeral home owners. I encourage you to reconsider the reinstatement of this grandfather clause and amendment in its entirety, or to rewrite some of the legislation pertaining to these prep rooms so that we can have embalmed, casketed bodies in these funeral homes without the upgrade. Please remember, over time, this should go away. Buildings are replaced, businesses are sold, buildings are remodeled, and in each of these circumstances, prep rooms in those buildings must be updated. Please help redraw the current prep room code to a higher standard that will benefit both funeral home owners and establishments and the general public as a whole. Thank you.
Thank you very much for taking the time to be here. Representative Knobloch.
And if I could just interject with one example in terms of the Dandrill Funeral Home in St. Cloud, for example. They have their main funeral home in downtown St. Cloud. They have a branch funeral home in St. Joseph, 8 miles away. I think it's the only funeral home in the city of St. Joseph. That one does not have a prep room. Obviously, it's not a big deal to do the embalming and such at their St. Cloud location and then have a viewing or a funeral at their St. Joseph location 8 miles away. But without adopting this bill, they'll no longer be able to do that without spending either $100,000 to add on to their funeral home in St. Joseph, or just be faced with the decision to just close the St. Joe Funeral Home. So, members, I'd appreciate your support of the bill as amended and be willing to take questions.
Thank you, Representative Knobloch. And we do have just a testifier who has concerns about the bill. We'll finish up with testifiers and then go to member questions. So, Ms. Cook, I believe, if you could come forward and introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Judy Cook with Cook Girard Associates. I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Funeral Directors Association, which represents funeral homes throughout the state in all cities, large and small. Here today to testify in opposition to House File 2469 as amended. We appreciate the time that Representative Knobloch has taken to visit with our members and talk with us. Recognize Mr. Daniels, who is a good member of the association. As you know, the association members don't always agree on everything. So this seems like a very straightforward and simple issue, but it's a little more complicated, and I'll try to summarize it for you without taking too much time. So in 1997, as you heard, the legislature updated requirements for embalming prep rooms for funeral establishments, and this grandfather clause was included, as was described by Mr. Daniels. And so basically you were grandfathered in whether you're using the prep room or not, unless there was a change in ownership, a physical location, or a remodel. And then the prep room had to be brought up to code. Since then, there has been a lot of confusion among funeral directors about the grandfather clause and, to some extent, some inconsistent compliance. For example, some funeral establishments with multiple locations brought all prep rooms up to code when a funeral home is sold from, like, a parent to a child, you know, to obviously a qualified person, but some did not. Since that time, we've also seen, as Mr. Daniel stated, an increasing trend of funeral homes with multiple locations using a central prep room for all embalming and prep. Last year, the Department of Health proposed legislation to eliminate the grandfather clause, which MFDA did not oppose, because we agree with the belief that all prep rooms should be up to code. So the issue now is whether or not a satellite prep room should be required to be fully compliant. And this issue came forward about 3 years ago when there was a lawsuit, and the Department of Health had a lot of conversations with our members, with the Minnesota Funeral Directors, and the Minnesota Funeral Directors took the issue out to all of their district meetings throughout the state, talked to all of their members. And a lot of the questions that were asked, actually Mr. Daniels raised a couple of them, should there be a distance if you were going to permit this in statute, 50 miles, 100 miles, less, maybe an adjoining county? Should families have to be informed if a body is being moved? Should prep rooms not being used be decommissioned, as he mentioned, so that that space is available for other uses? Because right now, you even if you're not using it, you shouldn't use it for something else. And should there be a time limit for how long human remains could be held at a funeral home without an operational prep room, which would then be comparable to, for example, a church or other location where there may be a revival or a funeral where there are, where human remains are present for a short time. And to be honest, we did not reach consensus on these issues. So based on all the discussion and input from members, MFDA at that time adopted a position that all funeral homes where human remains are present should have a prep room up to code, even if prep is not performed at that location. And one of the considerations for the association in this decision was that many funeral homes had already invested in updating all prep rooms to be consistent with the law. So when Representative Knobloch introduced this bill, the MFDA board revisited the issue and reaffirmed their position again, and a lot of additional members, because of the law, have already invested in updating their prep rooms. So there are a number of questions that I think need to be considered, as Mr. Daniels suggested. The other thing that is in the amendment is that the bill does not specify that other locations must have the same ownership as the funeral establishment where the prep is being performed. We think that raises additional questions. And also, the other concern is that on lines 1.7 to 1.10, the amendment language removes the July 17th effective date that was the elimination of the grandfather clause. That was an agreement reached last year to give ample time for funeral homes to get their prep rooms up to code. And so this means that all prep rooms would have to be up to code in just a few months. And so appreciate your consideration of our concerns, of the Minnesota Funeral Directors Association, and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for being here. Members, anyone else in the audience wants to testify for or against the bill? Not seeing any. Representative Liebling has a question.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So I wanted to ask the first group of testifiers, or maybe Representative Knobloch, why we need to force any funeral home to have an embalming room if it isn't, in fact, doing embalming. I mean, I see what your bill is doing, and I totally support this, but frankly, I don't think it goes far enough. And maybe staff can help me here, but, you know, we have in the state, you know, you may have funeral establishments that don't want to ever embalm. For example, you know, religious Jews do not embalm. Other people want natural funerals. You know, there's a whole, if we're interested in what consumers want, you know, I think people should be able to have a funeral establishment where they, if they don't do the practice of embalming, why should we make them have an embalming room at all? So I'd like to, maybe first staff can tell me, does the law actually require an embalming room for every funeral establishment right now?
Ms. Clarkquist?
Madam Chair and Representative Liebling, that's my understanding.
Okay, so.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So Representative Knobloch, you know, if we go as far as you're going here, why are we making them, I think this is very reasonable. if one funeral establishment has branches and they want to do the embalming in one central place, and you know their customers know that, then I don't have a problem with that. But if they don't want to do embalming, why should we make them have an embalming room at all?
Representative Knobloch.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, of course we're not requiring bodies to be embalmed. I mean, but the code currently requires these prep rooms that allow for embalming or allow for the ability to have bodies embalmed. That is what is in the law and the code right now, and I guess I wasn't really trying to address that issue. You're bringing up a different issue, which is, you know, certainly a legitimate issue as funeral practices change, as different people with different customs have funerals and move into the state, but I think that's really an issue for a different bill. I mean, we are maintaining the exact same standards for the current prep rooms as now exist. We're just saying that you don't need to have a prep room at every single funeral home as long as you've got one that qualifies and meets state code.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess, okay, so I know probably my bringing this up maybe gets a little, your bill into a bit more trouble than it needed, I guess. But really, I view this as something that blocks entry into the market, frankly, because it raises the cost of starting a funeral home for somebody who doesn't even necessarily want to do this at all. Probably sort of the same concern that your testifiers have about, you know, in a little different flavor, I guess. So I know that's not before us. Maybe that's part of what Ms. Cook is worried about, actually. This opens the door. It's a little bit of a slippery slope, and actually I think that would be a good thing. She mentioned that one of her rationales that I understood was she was saying some people did it, so everybody should have to do it, which to me seems kind of like a silly reason to require people to do something and spend a lot of money bringing these rooms up to code. So I do have one kind of more question about the language of the bill, and that is on the back of the back of the bill, maybe this got fixed with the amendment, 2.3.
It was a delete all amendment, Representative Liebling.
Okay, well, it was the 0914 amendment?
Yes.
Yep, Representative Liebling, it was the 0914, and then it is a delete everything amendment.
Okay,
so.
Okay. Thank you then.
Okay, members, I'm not seeing any other questions. Do we have one other person who wanted to testify? Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and then briefly proceed with your testimony.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Gilbert Acevedo. I'm Assistant Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Health. I want to thank you for hearing this bill, and I want to thank Representative Mal Block for bringing the bill forward. It's a very important subject, and there's a lot of discussion that has been going on for several years around this topic. But I was hoping to maybe add some clarity to some of the questions that were coming up, in particular the question that Representative Liebling mentioned. As Ms. Cook mentioned earlier in her testimony, there was a lawsuit that was placed where a funeral owner wanted to have a funeral home but not do embalming and not bring human remains in. So in essence, what they wanted to do was have, lack of a better word, kind of have a storefront where they would be able to conduct business but not bring human remains. The way the law was written, the individual had to bring a prep room up to standard. And so a lawsuit ensued, and what ended up happening is that the court said that was unconstitutional. You cannot do that. So the legislature asked the Department of Health to work with the industry to come up with a solution about this question, and that was the discussion that Ms. Cook said, that they went out and talked to the various members and come up with a number of concerns and also try to come up with some solutions. What ended up happening was in 2014, a law was passed that said that if you are bringing human remains into a funeral home and you're intending to use that funeral home as a funeral home and bringing it in, human remains into the funeral home, dead human remains, that you would have to have a prep room. So that's where the law started to evolve, saying that every funeral home had to have a prep room if you're bringing dead human remains into the prep room. That was counter or conflicted with the grandfather clause. The grandfather clause basically said, prior to 1997, if you didn't use your the prep room for 12 months prior to that, when the law was put in place, you didn't have to update your prep room. And I think there was an assumption there that the prep room was not going to continue to be used. And what we found over the years is that funeral homes continue to use the prep rooms, even though there were ownership changes and there has been other types of changes done to the funeral home, to the prep room. But it was a very unsafe prep room, and it didn't meet current standards, plumbing standards, OSHA standards, and a number of other standards as well. The way this bill is introduced right now, the department is willing to support Representative Nadla in that we feel that if a funeral home is not planning to use a prep room, they should not have to have an active prep room. But currently, the way the law is written, it says that you have to have an updated prep room. And so it's a very confusing, it's a very emotional issue. I will say that there are a number of funeral homes that are operating prep rooms right now, at least prior to last year's law, that was a very unsafe prep room based on the Department of Health's inspections.
Okay, thank you for that. We appreciate you being here to help with clarification. Members, we don't have any other questions at this time, so I will renew my motion that House File 2469, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Knobloch.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
And Representative Knobloch, you have the next bill up on the calendar, House File... or not on the calendar, for the committee's agenda, House File 2470. And Representative Knobloch, I will move that House File 2470 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. We have the bill in front of us, and Representative Knobloch, I understand you have an amendment. Excuse me, Representative Knobloch.
I think there's a technical amendment to it, yes. This was an amendment that the department brought forward that basically they said that they couldn't meet the timeline of the original bill. And so all this does is change the implementation dates.
Okay. So, Representative Knobloch, could you tell me, we have a couple amendments in our packet. Can you speak to which one is your amendment?
Wait a minute here. Sorry. You know, actually, I think... I take that back. I think that the bill was changed, I believe, to incorporate the concern that the department had that had originally come up. So I don't believe any of these amendments are mine. I'm sorry.
Okay. No problem. And we'll have staff just clarify that that was, in fact, taken care of, just to make sure we're all on the same page. So then, members, to that point, we do have a few other amendments in our packets, but first, why don't we have the author explain his bill, speak to his bill, and then we'll take up amendments. So, Representative Knobloch, your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. House File 2470 is a bill that deals with a very local and perhaps unique situation that allows licensed daycare centers that are located in a city that is in more than one county to have their subsidized daycare reimbursed at the rate offered by the highest county. The city of St. Cloud is in three counties, Stearns, Benton, and Sherburne County. I have a constituent who owns a building in Benton County that has housed a daycare facility. The original tenant of the facility had previously operated their daycare facility in Stearns County. When they opened the facility in Benton County, they found the Benton County rate was significantly lower than either the Stearns or Sherburne County rate, even though their daycare was just a few hundred feet from the Sherburne County line. For example, today the Benton County hourly rate is 35% to 62% below the Stearns County rate. This is because daycare rates are based on a formula based on looking at other rates within the county, because there are very few daycares within Benton County, and many of them are on the eastern part of the county with a very small sample size. They're not very representative of what daycare costs in the city of St. Cloud actually are. This bill would basically, in a case like this, adjust it to the highest county's rate whenever you've got a city that is in more than two counties. The bill has a very nominal fiscal note of $58,000 for 2017 and a few hundred thousand dollars a year after that. I don't think we should be penalizing one side of town over the other when they are all effectively in the same market if they're all in the same city. And so I would urge your support of the bill. And the client I have for this, he was not able to be here. He's out of town, but he did send a letter of support that I could also read. But I guess in the interest of time, it says much the same thing that talks about here. This daycare he had actually, because of this, in part, did close. They are now attempting to reopen it underneath new ownership. But again, you know, it's in the city of St. Cloud. If you're in the city, you're pretty much all in the same daycare market, whether you're in Stearns County, Benton County, or Sherburn County. We shouldn't be in a situation where one county's daycare reimbursement rate is substantially below the rates of the others when they're all in the same market. And I stand for questions.
Thank you, Representative Knobloch. And I will just see, is there anyone in the audience who wants to testify for or against the bill? Not seeing any. We will move to amendments. There are amendments in our packet. I'm not sure who they belong to. Is there anyone who wants to speak for or offer the amendments in our packets?
Madam Chair.
Representative Moran.
Thank you. So, Representative Knobloch, I think just yesterday we had a bill up in here that talked about the importance of scholarships and parents have an opportunity to have those scholarships to in order to have their child in a quality care center, right? And that is, it's really, really important. It's really about, you know, kids having an opportunity to be in quality care so that they can enter kindergarten ready and prepared and reading by third grade, and all the indicators say that if that happens, that they will have a better opportunity to be successful in school and thus in life. And so the A1 amendment, I'd like to move the A1 amendment, that really states that beginning in July 1st of 2016, raising the CCAP reimbursement rate from 25% to 75% of the most recent biennium child care provider rate survey. So we want to raise the rate from the current rate of 25% to 75%. And one of the reasons that I brought this amendment forward is what I stated earlier, is that often enough daycare providers are looking at the rate that they are being reimbursed at 25%. And often enough, they are making a choice on whether or not in their small business, whether or not they're going to take a CCAP child when they're going to be reimbursed at 25%, or whether they can take a parent who can just pay the full rate. And so my hope is that, you know, as we look at, you know, counties like Benton County, where there are 114 families on the waiting list, or like Stearns County, where there are 138 parents on the waiting list, that we can create an opportunity or a will for daycare providers to really work to ensure that they are creating spaces in their small business and daycare center for a CCAP child. So my hope is that we can vote yes for this and support increasing the provider rates in order to ensure that those CCAP children are able to have a safe, nurturing environment to be at while their parent or parents are working or attending school or some type of training. And I would like to do a roll call.
Okay, members, Representative Moran is moving the A1 amendment. Discussion to the amendment. Representative Knobloch.
Well, I guess let me just first ask Representative Moran, do you know the cost of this amendment? I guess I think before people vote on it, it would be fair to know what this would cost. I suspect it's many tens of millions of dollars more than my bill, but do you know what it costs?
Yeah.
Representative Moran.
So approximately $26 million in the fall of 2017.
Okay, well.
Representative Knobloch.
Madam Chair, Representative Moran, I guess, you know, I'm bringing a bill that addresses a very local issue for one constituent. And in fact, I will tell you the name of my constituent because I could have read it when I read his letter. His name is Robert Inkster. And if you want to Google his name underneath the St. Cloud Times, you can see a letter to the editor from him against me in the last election because he supported my opponent. He's a very nice man who's a Democrat college professor at St. Cloud State who happens to own this particular building. But I've known him for years, and even if we've got some political differences, I still believe that this is a important issue to bring forward, and so I'm bringing it forward. But I guess I'd ask Representative Moran, you know, instead of trying to mess up my bill for my one constituent in this very unique situation that's probably unique in the state of Minnesota, or at least if there are any others, there's very few of them. I guess I'd ask you, why don't you just introduce this as a bill yourself? I mean, why are you trying to mess up my bill with an amendment that is going to cost, sounds like, several hundred times the cost of my bill?
Yeah, Madam Chair.
Representative Moran.
Representative Knobloch. I am not in the business of trying to mess up your bill. And I have introduced this bill. I have not gotten a hearing for it. But I really, really do think it's an important issue and problem. As in my district in Ramsey County, we have 711 families on the waiting list just to have access to child care so that they can go to school or attend work or a training. And it's really, really important that, as you know, I hope we all know the value of children being in quality care so that they can enter kindergarten reading, prepare and reading by third grade. As their parents are doing due diligence to be, you know, good citizens.
Representative Knobloch.
Madam Chair, I guess, you know, this obviously vastly expands the scope of the bill, and I guess I'm just trying to help one single constituent in my community who didn't even support me in the last election. But I believe, you know, there may be other people in the state that, not many, but a few that are in a situation like this for whom I think, for my constituent and others, something like this makes sense. And I guess I just really believe that this is the wrong place for this amendment, Representative Moran. And I guess I don't think that you should be trying to attach a bill that spends hundreds of times more than my little local bill. I think you should be dealing with this in a different way. And so I guess I would ask you one more time, Representative Moran, to withdraw your amendment.
Other discussion to the amendment? Not seeing any. Representative Moran moves.
Excuse me, Madam Chair.
Representative Knobloch.
I have other ways that I can get this language enacted, and I will withdraw my bill. Thank you very much.
Okay. Representative Knobloch withdraws his bill.
Representative Knobloch, the intent was not for you to withdraw your bill. That is not the intent.
But I am withdrawing it.
Okay. The bill is being withdrawn for today. Thank you, Representative Knobloch.
It's not even funny. It's disgusting. What that would have done is, that would have...
Members, we just need a brief minute to get our next author in the room.
Well, can I just put something on the record?
I'm ready. I'm ready to go.
All right.
Okay, members, we will do House File 2901, Representative Albright's bill. Representative Albright will move that House File 2901 be recommended to be re-referred to the General Register. We have the bill in front of us. I don't see any amendments. Representative Albright, to your bill.
Thank you, Chair and members. The Mental Health Providers Association of Minnesota is bringing forward House File 2901 to clarify somewhat confusing existing statutory language around integrated co-occurring disorder treatment. Integrated co-occurring disorder treatment is a system we have in Minnesota through which individuals receive treatment if assessed as having both a substance use disorder and a mental illness. The bill makes two simple changes. First, it modifies the screening requirements for integrated co-occurring disorders to include documentation of next steps that will be taken if a person screens positive for a co-occurring mental health or substance use disorder. Secondly, the bill allows qualified mental health professionals to skip the screening and move straight to a more comprehensive integrated diagnostic assessment that meets specific DHS requirements if they suspect a person has a co-occurring disorder. The Minnesota Health Providers Association of Minnesota has worked with mental health service stakeholders to find agreement on this language, including the Mental Health Legislative Network, NAMI Minnesota, and the Minnesota Department of Human Services. DHS has completed an unofficial fiscal analysis on this bill and reports a fiscal note of zero. At this time, I have with me Terry Schneider from the South Metro Human Services, who will further explain the need for the changes put forth in this bill. Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Terry Schneider. I'm a psychologist with South Metro Human Services. While the changes in this bill are seemingly small compared to other important issues coming before you this session, enacting the language in this bill will allow mental health professionals to spend more time focusing on supporting individuals to address their mental health and substance abuse issues. We ask the committee for support of the bill. As Representative Albright explained, this bill before you contains language that clarifies two areas of confusion and frustration that existed the way the current statutory language for integrated co-occurring disorder treatment is written. First change in the bill is the additional language requiring an individual performing a screening for co-occurring disorders to document what actions will be taken in response to the results of the screening. Current statutory language requires a screening for co-occurring disorders to be completed, but there's no further direction on the next steps should the screening, based on the screening results. The language in this bill requiring documentation of the next steps that will be taken on the results of the screening will ensure that the individuals subject to the screenings are provided thorough follow-up and next steps based on the results of the screening. Second change included in the bill is the detailed description of the limited situations where a screening for co-occurring disorders does not need to be completed, which include if a co-occurring disorder has been documented for the individual in the past 12 months, if the individual is already receiving or being referred for co-occurring disorder treatment, or when a mental health professional who meets Minnesota's specific training and experience requirements is performing an integrated diagnostic assessment that meets the requirements in rule. The diagnostic assessment is a much more thorough assessment than what a screen would be. This clarifies the situations in which a screening does not need to be completed will allow mental health professionals to more quickly begin the important work of supporting clients to address their co-occurring disorders. Thank you for the opportunity. I'll answer any questions that you have.
Thank you for taking the time to be here. Is there anyone else in the audience who wants to testify for or against the bill? Not seeing any members' questions. Not seeing any. It's a pretty straightforward bill. So with that, members, Representative Albright, unless you wanted to add anything.
I'm just going to shut up and sell.
Okay. Representative Albright will renew his motion that House File 2901 be recommended to be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Okay, members, we are going to take up House File 2628, Representative Dean's bill. Representative Dean will move that House File 2628 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. We have the bill before us, and I understand we have an A1 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'd like to move the A1 amendment.
Representative Dean moves the A1 amendment to get the bill in the order he would like. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Representative Dean, two-year bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This bill deals with trying to get family doctors into greater Minnesota and practicing there, and I want to welcome all of the members from the MMA on MMA Day at the Capitol. Appreciate you being here today and for all the great work that you do, and we'd like to be able to make sure that residency programs and family medicine is available for future doctors in the state of Minnesota, and that's what we are trying to do. House File 2628 restores state funds to help train family doctors to practice medicine outside the metropolitan area. Family medicine is in an area where we're facing a growing shortage of physicians. The primary role is vitally important to ensuring the availability of comprehensive health services in all communities across the state. Until last year, there was an appropriation in place for programs that train physicians to practice in greater Minnesota. The funding source was less than certain, and the language providing guidance to the Department of Health on how to administer this was very, very limited. The old provision was replaced, and over the interim, the interested parties met to develop more comprehensive program language, and this request to restore state funding to augment training for greater Minnesota family medicine doctors. I have with me Kate Dean, no relation, from the Duluth Family Practice Residency Program. I can tell you just a little bit more about the program, what we're trying to do, and take a very small step in the right direction for healthcare in greater Minnesota.
Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kate Dean. I'm the Director of Education at Essentia Health in Duluth, Minnesota, and I'm the Administrator of the Duluth Family Medicine Residency Program. And today I'm testifying on behalf of the Family Medicine Residency Programs in Minnesota that focus primarily on training physicians to serve in Minnesota communities outside of the metropolitan area. Minnesota is facing a shortage of family physicians. More and more, our baby boom doctors are retiring, and the shortage is most acute across communities in greater Minnesota. Family physicians that are practicing outside the metro area and away from the many specialists that are found at regional centers must be prepared for a broad array of medical contingencies. The local family medicine physician must be trained to respond to these conditions without the immediate assistance of specialists. The four family medicine residency programs that are training residents to serve greater Minnesota are located in St. Cloud, Mankato, Duluth, and Rochester. These programs have a good track record in having their graduates serve the communities across the state. Committee members should find in their packets maps that indicate where the graduates to these programs are now practicing. Under this proposal, these programs must have at least 25% of program graduates practice in greater Minnesota. The four greater Minnesota programs currently well exceed this level of performance, and they will need to be diligent in their recruiting to attract residents who follow up on their preference to practice outside the metro area. They will also need to continue training these physicians so that they have the skills they need to practice some distance from larger medical facilities. It should be noted that the program funds may not supplant funding from other sources. These funds must augment the program by improving facilities or expanding the training. Now, some examples of training which the programs may focus on include trauma care. Rural physicians must be in a position that they can stabilize patients before they ultimately receive more intensive care at larger centers. They would receive additional training in obstetrics, ensuring that rural family physicians are doing things like C-sections and able to let communities retain their ability to do obstetrics because these physicians are able to provide cesarean sections. Their programs will also focus on areas such as pediatrics so that these physicians are prepared as possible to properly diagnose and treat children's medical needs, looking at expanding training in behavioral medicine to better prepare the frontline medical professions to connect patients with the treatment they need to function in their communities, as well as areas such as advanced pharmacology. The institutions that host these residency programs are committed to training physicians to serve greater Minnesota communities. We, the health systems that are associated with these residencies, are already subsidizing the programs and we're requesting that the state provide these additional funds to augment, not supplant, funding available to thoroughly train competent, confident, compassionate family physicians for practice in Greater Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you for being here. Welcome to the committee. I didn't know if you had testimony you wanted to add, but if you do, introduce yourself and proceed.
Thanks. Sorry to crash the party, Madam Chair and representatives. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is John Andrews. I'm a pediatrician, and I'm the Associate Dean for Graduate Medical Education at the University of Minnesota. I want to thank you for the opportunity to address you today and also for your support of training an appropriate workforce for the state of Minnesota. We are a very large sponsor of graduate medical education in the state of Minnesota, and I wanted to put this bill in a little bit of a broader context. At the University of Minnesota, we sponsor about 1,000 trainees and 120 different specialty programs ranging from family medicine to endovascular surgical neuroradiology. Many of those graduates continue to practice in Minnesota. Over two-thirds of the graduates of our programs stay in the state of Minnesota, and about 15% of them will practice in Greater Minnesota and in rural areas. Of those 120 programs, 8 of them are family medicine programs. 5 of those family medicine programs are located in the metro area, and along with the program sponsored by United Health and by Hennepin County Medical Center, those graduates will practice in Greater Minnesota at a rate of about 25%. 3 of our programs are in Greater Minnesota. They were mentioned by Ms. Dean. They're in Duluth, Mankato, and St. Cloud. Over 75% of the graduates of those programs will practice in the state of Minnesota, and over two-thirds of them will practice in rural areas. And so this lends some empirical support to the idea that training people in Greater Minnesota leads to a physician workforce that's likely to stay and practice in Greater Minnesota. The support for our graduate medical education programs comes largely from the federal government. That support was capped with the Balanced Budget Act in 1997 and hasn't changed since then. And so efforts to enhance or expand training depend in a critical way on your support, on state support. And so I applaud Representative Dean's efforts to further support graduate medical education and family medicine in the state of Minnesota, because I think there's strong evidence that this will benefit the health of the population in Greater Minnesota. Thank you. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you for being here. We have a question from Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And actually, this is a question for Ms. Dean. Really like this bill. I like the training that's happening. Some of your enhanced training methods and things you're working with. Wondering about just the addiction training with prescription drugs and how that is being part of your protocol, I guess, if you can just expand that a little bit, because I know in rural Minnesota, we don't have enough pain med specialists out there, and general docs are doing a lot of prescribing because they want to help their patients. Can you tell me how that is being looked at currently on that? Thank you.
Ms. Dean. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. I can only speak to what's happening at the Duluth Family Medicine residency program. It's associated with Essentia Health, and as part of that health system, our residents are receiving the ongoing training that all of our physicians are getting right now, because as we look at the different issues with addiction and the opioid measures, everybody's learning. And so they're being incorporated into the same work. At this time, we haven't done anything that is specific to them because everyone is going through this ongoing training methods as we look at the changing landscape there. One piece that is very nice, though, as we're looking at the pharmacology and how you can deal with pain, whether it be therapeutically with prescription medications or other ways, we do have pharmacists that are actually faculty members at this residency program that have been able to help do some more in-depth pharmacology training on, you know, what the pathways are and how this is working. So they're getting that side, as well as we have a psychiatrist on faculty. We have some social workers there. So they're talking about some of the reasons that people end up potentially in these positions. So trying to get some of that piece on addiction training right now is actually happening congruently with the physicians within the health system. Thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I also really like this bill. I like this approach. I think this is sorely needed. And my question really is, you know, obviously, it's got to be sort of an arbitrary amount of money that we've got here, $1 million and $1 million. And I'm just wondering if anybody can give us a real estimate of how far that gets us. You know, I know that this training is really expensive, and that's part of the problem. But I think this lack of primary care physicians, not just in the rural area, but really for the whole state, is just a looming crisis. And so I'm very interested in having us address it and just, you know, I mean, just kind of not, it doesn't affect my support of the bill whatsoever, but just wonder if you can give us any idea how far we get with this amount of money.
So,
Dr. Andrews.
Yes. Madam Chair and representatives, thanks for the question. I'd like to address the direct cost of training the physicians, and I think Ms. Dean may have some comments about the curricular enhancements. To add a position to a residency program in family medicine really entails a three-year commitment to a trainee because that's the duration of training. The stipend and benefit costs, as well as some administrative overhead, amount to probably about $80,000 per year per trainee. So the full cost of training someone in family medicine, just the direct cost of employing that physician for the period of time that they're in the program, is probably about $250,000 for a single physician. And then obviously the funds could be used for other curricular enhancements to the program, and I would defer to Ms. Dean to talk about that.
And Representative Liebling.
Representative Dean.
Just as a clarification, there was $1 million before that was removed in the last conference committee. Was not very happy about that, but that's what happened. I feel bad about that. I want to restore that. And if we can do more, we certainly will.
Okay. Ms. Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'd like to address what we at the Duluth Family Medicine Residency Program did with our portion of the $1 million in the past to give you an idea of how far this can go. Based on the formula that was used, we received approximately $340,000 for 2 years. And with that money, we were able to start with our pharmacy program, which allows us to have two pharmacists who are on the faculty, as well as the support of a pharmacy resident, an ambulatory care pharmacy resident, who's in the training clinic with our residents. So that was one area that allowed us to develop some more interprofessional practice and collaboration and education. We also were able to enhance our behavioral medical staff. We added a clinical psychologist. This provided assistance within the clinical training site, as well as for didactics and other education. So those were two big areas where we expanded faculty positions with that. It was also that freed up operating funds, we were able to add a new ultrasound system, which we had not had in the past, so that we were able to assist with some ultrasound-guided injections and things like this with an additional training that our residents received. We were able to use some of those funds to send our program director to a national training that they were able to bring back more education that they shared with the rest of the team. You know, we often laugh and say that residency programs are not in the business to make money. Education can be expensive, and so many of these were enhancements to the education and pieces that our normal operating costs or funds were not going to permit. So those are some of the areas that it went, but I do think it's important to note that while we started those new faculty positions, we've been able to, thanks to the help of our health systems, which do this additional funding, those were continued on. They did not stop with the end of this grant, and I think that's a good testament to the systems of the importance of continuing that training. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to follow up, Representative Dean, I was no way meant as a criticism. I just, you know, we all know that this is just an enormous problem, and in future years we're just going to have to do, a lot more, because recently I've been hearing that the problem's even getting worse, I mean, with, fewer students wanting to go into primary care. So, we're going to have to continue to wrestle with this. Thank you.
Okay. With that, we don't have any other questions. Representative Dean, final word on your bill?
I think it's incumbent upon us to continue to support rural medicine and family practice and family medicine in greater Minnesota. And this is one of the ways that we can do that. If we can get them to train here, we can get them to stay here. And from an economic development standpoint, it's very, very important, particularly to little tiny towns where the doctor is one of those vital organs of a small town. As the doctor, the pharmacy, and employer, the grain elevator, there's things that are really vital organs to small towns. The doc is one of those that can keep the door to the hospital open, so we want to make sure that we do that. We can't find them spouses, which is really the way to keep them here in Minnesota, but we can do this. So this is one thing we can do. We'd appreciate your support.
Okay, members, with that, I'm not seeing any other comments or questions. So with that, Representative Dean renews his motion that House File 2628, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Dean. Members, next, we're going to take up Representative Grunhagen's bill, House File 1560. And members, we have Representative Grunhagen's bill and then two, dare I say, brief bills after that. We do have the room reserved for 6:45 post caucuses, so just so members know kind of what the roadmap looks like. If we can finish in 20 minutes, we will do that. Otherwise, we're set for later on this evening. Representative Grunhagen, to your bill, I don't see any amendments, and so I will let you speak to your bill.
Do I need it moved?
Excuse me, Representative Grunhagen. I will move your bill. I will move that House File 1560 be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. Representative Grunhagen, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Basically, what this bill does, in the majority of hospitals or even clinics, is the patient consent bill. And currently, you should have a copy of it, I believe. For examples, and there, right now you simply sign the bottom and you consent to 10 to 12 different things regarding your health care. What this bill would do is allow you to initial each one and therefore give you a better opportunity to understand exactly what you're releasing. Yesterday we had a letter from the MMA and Minnesota Hospital Association with some concerns regarding the bill, and I'll address that after the testifiers. At this point, I'd like to give Matt an opportunity to speak.
Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Matt Flanders. I'm the legislative specialist at Citizens Council for Health Freedom. If there's a page, I do have some handouts that I'd like to give to each of the members and the staff.
You could have the page come forward and distribute the materials.
But continuing on, I'm here today to read the testimony of Ms. Twyla Braves, the president of CCHF. If you have any questions, I am happy to answer them to the best of my ability, and if I am not able to answer, I will refer those questions to Twyla and report back. To Ms. Braves' testimony, Madam Chair and members of the committee, Citizens Council for Health Freedom often receives copies of consent forms from concerned patients. These consent to treat forms often include a roster of other items to which patients are essentially required to consent if they want access to care. That's because there's only one line for the patient's signature and nothing giving them the right to say no to the other items in the list. For example, look at the Health Partners form in your packet. It says that changes aren't accepted. Given the strong Minnesota medical privacy laws, we look at these consolidated consent forms as the way hospitals and clinics get around the various consent requirements in Minnesota law, requirements that are stronger than those in the federal HIPAA privacy rule. The right of consent means you have a choice. If you don't have a choice, it's not actually consent. As an example of this lack of choice, the North Memorial form shows 9 items, including consent for treatment in item A. At the very end, you're asked to sign a statement that says, I consent to all of the above. Above that single signature, patients are forced to consent at B to HIV testing for if a physician decides they should be tested. C is problematic because Minnesotans by law must be asked for their consent to have data shared and used for payment, for treatment, and for healthcare operations, as the Mayo Notice of Privacy Practices states. Again, real consent means you have a choice, but the single signature forces the patient to agree, despite how broadly defined these terms are. For example, healthcare operations is 390 words long. The single signature submits patients at D to medical and genetic research. Their only option is to later submit a written objection. Health Partners does it better. They have a box, but it's dissent, an opt-out, not a request for authorization, as required by state law. Again, the Mayo Clinic Notice of Privacy Practices notes this distinction between HIPAA and Minnesota law. appears careless. Do patients really want their presence disclosed to anyone who may inquire about them by name? How about a starstruck fan or a vengeful ex? Yet that's what could happen under this single signature. And F is only intended to give legal protection to North Memorial against patients who lose property at the facility. With one signature, patients give up these rights in order to access care. Might this provision also protect the hospital if the patient's medical data is breached by hackers? G and I are sweeping authorizations. To get care, the patient is forced to agree to significant releases of information, including to hospitals, clinics, or providers unrelated to North Memorial, such as other providers or accountable care organizations in which North Memorial participates. Again, one signature, no choice. H discusses the notice of privacy practices, but patients can refuse to sign the statement and still be treated, as the Office of Civil Rights states in number 4 in the document in your handout. So what's missing that should be there? Consent for a use of a record locator service as required by Minnesota Statute 144.293 Subdivision 8. North Memorial's Notice of Privacy Practices says it may access and share health information electronically through a health information exchange. The record locator service is a key component of such exchange. Also missing is an option for the patient to not share data with their health plan if they pay cash. That's a right that cash payers have under HIPAA. We mailed a letter to North Memorial CEO on February 26, 2015, which is in your packet, but we never received a response. House File 1560 is an important bill that will assure Minnesotans that their consent rights under current Minnesota law will not be violated. We have found a shining example of what this could look like, the Silverman Ankle and Foot Clinic, which is in your packet. It's a part of the Allina Integrated Medical Network located in Minneapolis, and it already gives patients these itemized consents. If healthcare facilities are going to have these consolidated forms, these types of choices should be standard practice, allowing Minnesotans to exercise their legal rights to consent or refuse to consent. These state-mandated choices are already theirs under Minnesota law, but these consent forms violate those legal patient privacy and consent rights by a single signature and no choices. We ask for your support and to vote yes on House File 1560. Thank you.
Thank you. Before we go to member questions, I'll see, is there anyone else in the room who wants to testify for the bill or that has concerns about the bill? Please come forward. You can go in whichever order you prefer. Welcome to the committee.
I'll be quick.
If you could introduce yourself and proceed.
My name is Don Lee. I live in Eagan. And I just have some concerns. Although I fully support this bill in its intent, I have some experience with this. I recently went to a dermatologist to talk about a minor skin problem. They handed me a consent form that had a whole bunch of stuff I didn't want shared, and I didn't want to sign the consent form. I told them I'd be paying cash, and they said, nope, we won't talk to you. So this is a problem. It's touched me, and I am very concerned about the whole issue. Medical care has become a huge bureaucratic nightmare, even for people who are not going through third-party payers like Medicare. And I fully support the effort to decouple these enormous, you know, consent efforts from the provision of care. However, I'm also a computer guy. I've done software all my life. And I have concerns about the way this is being done, because to have a line item veto essentially in these health records means that the cost of changing the consent record keeping would be pretty substantial, and I fear that. The other concern I have is, and I can explain in detail if anybody wants to know how databases work and why it would be so expensive, but the cost would be very substantial. The other concern I have is that, and I want to tell this with a story, you might have heard in the news a while back about a workplace where there were two people working in the workplace. One was a blind person that had to have a guide dog. The other person was allergic to dogs. They both had a right to keep their job, but they couldn't be in the same room. And either one of them could be fired and could start a lawsuit. This is what happens when you have mandates from a central authority. They end up competing. And my fear is that what we're doing is we have a whole bunch of mandates right now saying that you have to release this data and you have to provide that data and you have to do this and you have to do that. And that's probably what's driving the providers to give us these forms, HIPAA and all these other things, driving this dermatologist to say, if you don't sign the form, we won't talk to you. And I would much, much rather figure out what is driving all this and remove the mandates that is causing the problem rather than add yet another mandate that is probably going to conflict with something else in a way that we may not be able to foresee today. And that's all I have to say today. Thank you
very much for your insights. It's appreciated. To the other gentleman, welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Dr. Stephen Huey. I'm a licensed psychologist who has practiced in the Twin Cities for the last 34 years. In a culture in which privacy rights are continually eroded, this important bill protects Minnesota patients by giving them control over what happens to their most deeply personal information. This is exactly the way medical and psychological releases have always been written in the past. In fact, this bill is consistent with the so-called Minnesota Standard Consent Form authored by the Department of Health themselves, but which unfortunately one never sees used. Changes over the last several years are taking choice away from the individual. Items to consent to are bundled together and patients are asked to sign at the bottom. In order to get health information usefully sent to a specific provider, for example, people have to agree that it can be sent to unspecified providers in general that the treatment facility chooses, and to unspecified researchers and to third-party payers and so forth. HF 1560 returns things to the way they were and should be, and it does another important thing. Signing off on each item helps individuals protect their own privacy by forcing them to take an extra minute and actually read the form. The bill helpfully counteracts the tendency we all have, especially when experiencing the stress of a medical visit, to sign such forms without reading them while the receptionist waits expectantly. At the bottom line, giving patients the option to say yes or no to releasing their personal information to each different entity is a no-brainer. It makes healthcare feel safer. This simple, reasonable amendment is much needed. Thank you for holding this important hearing on privacy in Minnesota.
Thank you for taking the time to be here. I'm not seeing any other testifiers. I'm sorry. I apologize. If you could come forward. Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and proceed.
Okay. My name is Sandra K. Simonson, and Madam Chair and members of the committee, I have been a licensed independent clinical social worker for 22 plus years and a social worker for 30 plus years. I have also taught social work as adjunct faculty. Mm-hmm. I support House File 1560 as it promotes better informed and empowered healthcare consumers. I view the danger of blanket releases, which is what we are discussing today, is so concerning that I spent numerous hours over 3 weeks last March studying the changes that were implemented within HIPAA in late 2013, so that within my own private therapy practice, I could adopt a standard of practice regarding disclosure. I developed such standards to guard against the request of records based on a blanket release and to better inform my clients of their legal rights. I made such an extensive effort to do so, and I am here today because the Code of Ethics of Social Work prompts me to do so. We can't be naive that since late 2013, medical data has become big money, both for those with legal and illegal intent. This proposed law will allow healthcare consumers to be better informed of their rights and with whom their medical data is being shared. The changes made at the federal level in late 2013 were done to improve treatment, not to create huge medical data banks, which blanket releases allow. Thank you for your attention to this crucial matter.
Thank you so much for taking the time to be here. Next testifier. Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Dr. Robert Geis. I practice medicine in St. Paul for many decades. I ran a large specialty surgical clinic as the president of the clinic for many decades. We received many consultations, and of course we would send out some of our patients for consultation. So I'm quite familiar with coordination. That's the business of medicine, basically. And it isn't very complicated. I looked at this bill and I said, well, somebody might reasonably complain about this for a couple of reasons, maybe three reasons even. They might object that it empowers patients to decide what's intimate personal data they might want to have acknowledged out in the world or not. And there are checklists here which aren't mandated. You can have any kind of mandate. You can have any kind of checklist you want. It leaves it open for the clinic to develop their own. Well, first of all, how about big data? Well, big data sweeps where everything in the record is swept up in a big data. That is supposed to create public population health. Well, we'll discuss that later, but that's not true. Secondly, anyone who's been to a medical clinic knows that when you walk in, you get this two or three pieces of paper with all sorts of checklists for your health history and so forth, your present complaint, which can be very complex in an orthopedic office, I know, when you fill them out. Very much good data, by the way, but all nonetheless quite quite personal. Now, those look complicated, and those are far more complex than any consent form. Consent form that just consents for everything, of course, is very non-complex. Well, it'd be neat if we could have a box that says, yes, you can send everything, or no, you can't send anything without me saying so. Or maybe a third one that says, you can send specific data to a certain doctor I'm going to go see. That would make sense, but those are the things clinics can develop. The exceptions, of course, to our consent forms are that there are public health reports that must be done. For example, for cancer, for measles, for gunshot wounds, and so forth. You're all quite familiar with that. But the problem with the sweep of big data is you have policy wonks and insurance companies who fundamentally want to find out where there's bad patient behavior. They're too obese, for example, or they smoke or they drink. They also want to correct and police doctors who they think are bad if they spend too much money on patient care. Those are things the public health reports don't do. They are separate. So back to the public health and consent forms.
Yes. And sir, I don't want to be rude. I'm going to interrupt briefly.
Sure.
We have one more testifier.
Cut it off, okay?
Yep, and just because we have to be out of the room in just a couple of minutes, so we'll be coming back to discuss the bill as members. I want to make all the testifiers
speak. I urge your passage of this bill. It's not complex. It's common sense, and privacy really does matter. Thank you very much.
Thank you for taking the time to be here. And to the testifiers, of course, when we come back, you are welcome to be here. We will have a gap in time, so I want to make sure we get our final testifier in. Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself.
I'll try
proceed.
To be fast. My name is Suzanne Peach. I'm from Andover, and I thought I was just going to come share my testimony, so I'll buzz through this quick. I went to, about 4 weeks ago, went to the doctors. I had already been informed that the HIPAA was not exactly being honest to me in where my information was being released. And so I decided to challenge them and said I would not sign this form, my HIPAA form, so they say. And I asked them, is this just for the HIPAA form, this form here? I want to not sign the HIPAA form today. And she said, oh, no, you know, this also is for billing your insurance company. I said, well, no, that's okay. You can bill my insurance company. You have for years, and I'm okay with that. I want them to pay my bills. But I'm not okay with you releasing information that I have not told you who I want it to go to. Of course, they said, well, then we cannot see you today.
And I said, no, by law, which luckily I had it in my phone, I was able to show her, you can't. She says, well, we don't know anything that you're talking about. I said, well, you can get your supervisor, but I know I do not have to sign that form, and you do have to see me today. And they said, well, then we have to charge you $150. I said, $150, great. You know, I can do that too, I guess. And I guess I have to bill my insurance company because you're apparently not going to do that now because this form is for more than just my insurance company. I told her, how about you give me the form that I can sign for just my insurance company? I will sign that for you today, and I want you to bill them. That's not what I'm worried about, and their whole argument was a billing, to be honest. And I said, it's not billing for me, it's my rights to protect my information. And so, of course, eventually the supervisor brought me and let me see my doctor. Funny stuff with all of that. They actually didn't know if they should see me that day. Eventually, the supervisor said, by law, we must see her. So, yes, I was seen. I did sign this form for them with the words that you have rights to my signature here because I refuse to release everything outside to any external sources. You may only release this signature of mine to my insurance company for billing purposes only. When I looked at the information that they just sent me in regards to what this HIPAA form really is, the HIPAA form is so vague in here. There's over six different places listed on the alternative information that they're going to release my info to. Now, they've labeled it out for me of where it's going to go to, but not to who. Who is going to receive this information? It doesn't tell me who I'm signing it off to. It doesn't tell me where it's going to go. Is it the government? Is it the back, you know, store down the area? Who wants my information? If it's for research, can I have the right to say yes or no to that? I know how to read, so I understand if there are people who can't. It might be difficult to fill out a checkbox or their initials. But really, the people who work behind a desk are capable. That's why they're hired. They can say, this means this, this means that, check means this, that means that for people who can't read. This is not about signatures, checks of yes and no's. It's about the rights of who protects my info. I am the one who protects six of my children's information. Who better than the mother of her children to decide who's going to get that info on her child? Me. I want to be able to say who. And I didn't mean to bring this up, but I found this letter over there, and it said something about, what is these people who wrote this here, Minnesota Medical Association? Oh, please. I'm here. I'm sorry.
And Miss, we'll have to wrap Peach. Up in about 30 seconds. So if you could
wrap
your
up.
Testimony.
Don't tell me that it's going to be impossible to coordinate my care and my records with my health in the places. I came to you, to my doctor. I want to go to the specialist. I want to go to that hospital. Yeah, I'm going to say, which, by the way, they already have this. You have to sign forms already that says they can share that information already with the hospital that you're going to go to for your specialty care. It already exists. Don't tell me this by giving me boxes at the beginning of my entrance into the clinic is going to take away my right to go to my doctor or the hospital or any other care provider. Bull.
Okay, members, thank you for your testimony. Thank you to all the testifiers. I know some of you drove in. We really appreciate it. Members, we are going to go into recess right now and take up this bill immediately following six. We will. I wanted to open it up to discussion for members. I assumed, unless members feel ready to vote on this, I thought we would probably have some discussion when we got back. So, members, we will recess. We're coming back at 6:45. If that gets moved a little bit later than that, we will make sure to give plenty of email notice. But right now, we're set for 6:45 in this room. We'll finish Representative Grunhagen's bill. Please keep the final two bills in your packets. And members, with that, we are in recess. Okay, members, we will come back from recess. And we broke right as we were finishing testimony for Representative Grunhagen's bill. So just to refresh members' memories, we are on House File 1560.
Thank you.
And I believe we are done with testimony, but I'll just make sure. Is there anyone else in the audience who wants to testify for or against House File 1560? Okay, not seeing any. Members, questions? Any concerns? Okay, not seeing any. Representative Grunhagen, to your bill.
Just a couple comments. The letter from the MMA and the Hospital Association, I do want to meet with them. I have been talking with them some, and then I've got some responses back. So between now and civil law, I'm hoping to bring a relative peace in the valley to the some of their concerns. Thank you, committee members.
All right. Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. Appreciate it. So, members, with that, I will renew my motion that House File 1560 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human... be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you.
Members, next we will take up House File 2772, Representative Dean. And Representative Dean moves that House File 2772 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. Representative Dean, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 2772 has no amendments, is before you. This legislation is in response to a letter from CMS inviting states to apply for 1115 waiver for substance use disorder. The bill directs the Commissioner of DHS to seek a federal waiver and present an update to the legislature on February 1st, 2017. Many of you have heard of this issue from your IMDs who have reached out to us about their funding issues that they have. I would imagine, I think I've talked to almost everybody on this committee about that as well. I'll let Commissioner Higgins speak in greater detail about the mechanics of the waiver and about some of the specific effects on IMDs.
Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Linda Higgins. I'm a Hennepin County Commissioner. This legislation, as Representative Dean said, directs the Department of Human Services to apply for a federal Medicaid waiver to better serve our citizens who have substance abuse disorders. And let me just say, this waiver would not affect other disability services. A waiver of the IMD bed limit is necessary because IMD limits Medicaid to pay for services only in settings of 16 beds or less. Hennepin County has about 1,400 clients every month with substance use disorders who now frequent Hennepin County Medical Center's emergency department. With this waiver, we can treat them instead in another setting that could address treatment and housing and employment and other social service needs. This waiver could save Medicaid funds that are now paying for that really expensive emergency department services. You may know there are about 60 treatment facilities across Minnesota, including 16 in Hennepin County, who have lost their Medicaid funding because of this IMD limitation. This bill will improve our services by creating a unified plan to treat this disease as the chronic condition that it is. It will leverage federal funding against current state-only appropriations, such as the Chemical Dependency Revolving Fund, and it will allow Medicaid to finance services like housing and employment for some clients. This legislation will help us better serve many clients with substance abuse disorders. It will create better outcomes and end the revolving door for some clients, and I urge your passage of it. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience who wants to testify for or against the bill? Not seeing any members. Questions? Okay. Thank you so much for being here. I appreciate it. Representative Dean, any final word on your bill?
Just that the bill don't cost nothing, and we'll bring some federal money, and I appreciate your support.
Okay. Representative Dean renews his motion that House File 2772 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Dean. Members, our last bill up of the night is Representative Baker, House File 3026. And Representative Baker moves that House File 3026 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. We have the bill in front of us. I don't see any amendments. So, Representative Baker, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. What we have here is touched on a little bit with Representative Dean's bill. Last fall, DHS reclassified 37 chemical dependency providers as IMDs. This is a big deal because our facilities out there that are helping folks with chemical dependency have been paying a formula that is kind of complex, but we need to do a new formula plan if the bills are going to be changed in a way that pay these are going to be changed quite a bit. And this is the issue. So we need to make sure that this bill kind of corrects that. It takes the pressure off the counties. We need to make sure that the folks in the county that are referring folks to where they need to get the best help for chemical dependency are not being swayed by funding elements and formulas. So with me today, Madam Chair, I've got some testifiers much smarter than I am that will help explain this bill, but it's an important one, and I appreciate that tonight. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and proceed.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Lane Elmer. I'm the CEO of New Beginnings. We're a treatment center in Waverly, Minnesota. I'm also on the Board of Governors of MARCH, our trade association, and have been working closely with other providers and MATAD on this issue for the last few months. So Minnesota has long been recognized as a national leader in chemical dependency treatment, and that's been founded upon the creation of the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund in 1988, often referred to as the fund. And it's done a really good job of taking disparate funding sources from the federal, county, and state levels and streamlining the overall process for counties and social workers and providers to work together to get clients into placement when they need it. And as DHS showed in 2013, the fund's been a good economic benefit to the state because this patient population, their overall medical expenses have been reduced, crime has been down, and their overall employment has risen. So, as Representative Baker referenced before, we're here today because in November, 37 additional programs were identified as IMDs by DHS. And this goes, the definition of an IMD is any facility over 16 beds that serves a patient population that 50% or greater have a mental illness. And this issue goes all the way back to 1965 when the original Medicaid and Medicare laws were created. And at that time, IMDs were state psychiatric hospitals, which were very controversial, very costly at the time, and the federal government did not want to be subsidizing those. So, unfortunately, this definition has evolved over time and has included chemical dependency treatment programs, even though they are nothing like state psychiatric hospitals. And this is well known at the federal level that this is an incongruence, and there are multiple things being done at the federal level to try and change this, but we all know how long that takes, and sometimes it doesn't work at all. So in the meantime, Minnesota is being impacted, and what we're trying to do with this bill, which Tim will explain in some detail, is clean up some of the confusing funding mechanisms within the fund to be able to have counties not be placed with financial burdens to be referring to IMDs and have them be referring purely based off of clinical diagnosis and clinical need.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Tim Walsh. I'm a Vice President with Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge, and I'm also a member of MARCH and the Minnesota Association of Treatment Directors. And I think actually the Department of Human Services has stated the goals here very clearly, which is whether a facility is an IMD or a non-IMD should not affect clients' access, Minnesotans' access to treatment, nor should it affect the guarantee of public funding for those who qualify for public funding. And that's really what this bill does. Appreciate DHS's providing technical support on this bill. It does a few things. First of all, it codifies it. It makes it clear that IMD status should not be the basis for whether counties, tribes, and health plans make a placement in a facility. It really should be based upon their clinical needs, their treatment needs, and their diagnosis. It makes an even playing field between non-IMDs and IMDs. It sets it at 15%, whether an IMD or a non-IMD. Otherwise, those costs rise for counties up to 50% for most clients.
And also it provides a guarantee that the Department of Human Services will be providing that funding for people who qualify and who need that level of treatment. Provides that guarantee regardless of the status of whether a facility is an IMD or non-IMD. It doesn't fix all the problems, and it's just an interim or a bridge solution until the federal solutions are found through the waiver, which this dovetails very nicely with that. But it does buy us some time until then. You know about the overall problem with the epidemic of alcohol addiction, chemical addiction, opioid abuse, and so on. And, of course, this provides the funding and both the access for that. So we agree with DHS that the IMD classification should not affect Minnesotans' access to our public funding for residential chemical dependency treatment and co-occurring treatment, I have to add, based on the earlier bill, and we just urge your support for this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to both testifiers for being here. Really appreciate it. Is there anyone else in the audience who wants to testify for or against the bill? Not seeing anyone. Members, any questions? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So when it says in the bill, the commissioner shall not deny reimbursement, so does that mean then that state funds would be used to pay the whole cost? Because I'm not sure exactly how this works. Or does it or just mean that the reimbursement that wouldn't be denied is what the state would have paid if it was not an IMD. So if we were getting the federal share.
Mr. Walsh.
Madam Chair and Representative, what we didn't want to go to is in the details of the Consolidated Treatment Fund, but it is based on a formula, as Representative was talking about, which is an 85% share for the state and a 15% share for counties. And that's been the historical basis for paying for residential treatment, and it maintains that 85% share for the state and 15% for the counties. And it doesn't discriminate against IMDs and doesn't jack that rate up to 22.95% as a result. So that's the formula.
Representative Liebling.
So, Madam Chair, so is this so is there a cost to the bill?
Mr. Walsh. And Representative Liebling, I will say, too, we do have Matt Burdick from DHS who could also help explain the funding if that would.
And Madam Chair, was this going to finance?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes, it is going to finance. Next.
Do you want me to answer that? Okay. So,
Mr. Walsh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative, is there a cost? My understanding from the Department of Human Services and Brian Zervis is here, Deputy Director over our Policy Division. They have developed a fiscal note, but it's going through the MMB, and then after it goes through MMB, that's when it'll go to the finance committees, and then there will be discussions about then how will, within the overall budget, then how would that cost be addressed.
Representative Liebling, would you like to hear from the department?
Yeah, I think
also?
So, Madam Chair, but I do kind of have another question about it, too, and that is that, you know, this idea whether a treatment facility is an IMD should not be a factor in making placements. I mean, I guess I understand that on one level, but, you know, if there's a significant difference in cost and two treatment facilities could meet the person's need, I don't know why we would, in law, say that we couldn't use that as a factor. You know, I mean, if the treatment needs are met. I mean, obviously we don't want to have people going somewhere that's not appropriate for them just because it's cheaper. I mean, I think we probably all agree with that, but what this language seems to say is that even if two things were equal, we wouldn't be able to say on the basis of cost that they should go one place or the other.
Mr. Walsh.
Madam Chair and Representative Liebling, the three placement authorities in Minnesota are health plans and tribes and counties. In statute, they all, as placing authorities, they get to decide what is cost effective and what is appropriate. So this bill in no way takes away from them the ability to decide what is cost effective or what is appropriate. And so it will still be based on those two criteria.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, okay, that's good to know. I don't know if that's actually in conflict with this language then, but I guess I'd like to hear from DHS a little bit about that because, you know, if you say that this IMD designation is not, cannot be a factor, shall not be a factor in making placements, I don't know, maybe that still leaves it open that if something's more costly than something else for whatever reason, maybe they still have that authority. I mean, can you address that?
Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brian Zervis. I'm the Deputy Director of the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division at the Department of Human Services. Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, I think that the question I heard you ask is whether or not current practice, if the IMD determination, a program's IMD designation can be used as a determining factor to place or not.
Representative Liebling.
Well, no, thank you, Madam Chair. No, because what the bill is doing, the bill is taking away, it's saying that the treatment facility designation as an IMD shall not be a factor in making placements. So apparently right now it is, because it doesn't get the federal match otherwise.
Mr. Service.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling. The bill language would clarify and codify the current practice that IMD status is not to be used as a determining or using the determination of whether or not to place someone.
Oh. Representative Liebling.
Oh, okay. Madam Chair, thank you. Well, that is clarifying, so we already don't do it. Okay, and then I think the other piece I wanted you to address, even though this isn't the Finance Committee, I assume that, you know, I mean, there's going to be some cost, and can you just sort of give us maybe you could talk us through just a little bit again about how this financing piece works. I found that really confusing.
And can you repeat your last name?
Yeah, it's Zervis.
Zervis, yeah, excuse me.
Z-E-I-R-B-E-S.
Mr. Zervis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Liebling, to go back to the previous question about the funding and the county share, non-county share, it's dependent on the recipient's medical assistance status and the program's IMD designation or not. So there's a grid that sort of lays out if someone is a, let's say, for example, an adult in current law, an adult without children in a non-IMD, there's 100% federal financial coverage, so there's no cost to the state and county. For an adult with children or families with children going into a non-IMD program, that the federal financial participation is 50%, the state's is 35%, and then the county is 15%. If an MA-eligible individual is placed into an IMD, an Institute for Mental Disease, there's no federal financial participation. So that's where the state and county share. The county share is 22.95%, and the state share is 77.05%. And so what the bill language would outline is that instead of the 22.95% county share to the county, that would be 15% across the board. So whether a program is an IMD or is designated as an IMD or not would sort of balance the field from the county's point of view or the placing authority's point of view.
Okay.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I won't belabor it anymore. Thank you. That was helpful. And Representative Baker, maybe when this gets to finance, if you could give us that little grid visually, I think that would be really helpful because thinking of it that way is really helpful. Thank you.
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think, Representative Liebling, you ask a very good question. Because of the formulas, and they're so different whether it's single or a family, 15% with the county here, and it's a fiscal note I'm also looking forward to. So we'll have that finance when it goes there because it's a number that I certainly want to know. This is, again, as they mentioned, this is a bridge. We hope to get on the waiver programs. We get this cleaned up. It should not be a long-term thing. We need to make sure that all the facilities now that are being used as an IMD or a non-IMD are still going to be used just like they were before. We want this to be seamless, and so that's why we need the legislature's help. We'll have it ready.
Thank you for that, Representative Baker. Members, any other questions? Okay, not seeing any. Thank you so much to the testifiers for being here. So, Representative Baker removes his motion that House File 3026 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails.
Thank you,
Representative Baker. And members, thank you so much, and thank you to the audience. Apologize for keeping you into the evening on a very snowy evening. So truly apologize, but I hope everybody drives safely. And we will see you next week for our next regularly scheduled meeting. We are adjourned.